A castaway is a specialist in the difficult business of creating laughter. In a career spanning more than 30 years, he's worked with Les Dawson, Ronnie Corbett, Morecambe and Wise, Bruce Forsyth, Tommy Cooper, Kenny Everett, Dave Allen, Bob Hope, Jack Benny, Billy Connolly, and many, many more. Indeed, it's almost easy to list the comedians he's not written for. Asked to sum up his job, he once said, quite simply, "I'm a hack." He is Barry Cryer. Now, hack, of course, has got a rather derogatory sense to it, Barry. I take it you didn't mean it that way when you described yourself.
Not to me. No. It's an honourable word. No, I belong to... Somebody defined it rather nicely. I belong to the world of we don't want it good, we want it Monday. I'm like a journalist. Hack is a regional Grub Street, sort of Fleet Street word, isn't it?
That's right.
It's hacking away. It's working to the last phone call. Sammy Kahn said, which confessed the words of the music, the last phone call. You know, you're working to order most of the time, so I'm very proud of the word hack. I like it. It's good. Well, I'm a tradesman, a journeyman or whatever.
Well, you've been doing this and practicing this very difficult trade now for, and very successful for 30 years now. I wonder, when you got to your desert island, therefore, would you be so conditioned that you'd write jokes for the rest of your life for nobody there, or just for yourself?
There might be a day or two of withdrawal symptoms. No, I don't think I'd write jokes. A, I never write alone now, or with a partner, and B, the sheer... I enjoy the work, but the sheer weight taken off the shoulders. No, I'd probably sit there writing the pretentious poem and finishing the novel that was started 15 years ago and things like that.
And having collaborators so long in your life, therefore, having had a partner, would you be therefore be very lonely, do you think, on the island?
Very lonely indeed, yes. Hence the choice of my luxury item, which we will get to later in the programme.
What about music? I mean, how much of a solace would it be to you? What would it remind you of?
I'm a people-aholic. It would remind me of people mainly, and the eras in my life connect you with those people. Friends, really. Friends and family. Music, I love. But my choice of record is often more rhythmic than melodic. I love rhythm. And it's a background to me, music. I'm not a keen music student, but I love it around, atmospherically, and that would be the great solace on the desert island, just creating an atmosphere.
What about the first choice of record, then?
The first choice of record is... features a very dear friend of mine. It's Bad Penny Blues by Humphrey Lyttelton. We've been doing a show called I'm Sorry I Haven't a Clue for 15 years on Radio 4, and that's solidly mounted on friendship. And I first met Humphrey when I was at Leeds University in 1900 and typing error, and he was a great idol of mine, and I used to sit at his feet. And just now and again, when we're having a drink together, we've been friends for years now, I just look at him sometimes and think, it's him! But, you know, it'd ruin it if you started that, because he's the most unassuming man, but he's wonderful wit and a great friend. And Bad Penny Blues would sum up this whole era of people I like and have worked with, exemplified by the great Lyttelton.
Penny Blues, Humphrey Lyttelton. Barry Cryer, let's go back to the very beginning. Born in Yorkshire.
Yes, sir.
Was it in Leeds, in fact?
It was in Leeds.
It was in Leeds. And what kind of background was it? A showbiz background at all?
Not remotely, no. My dad died when I was about four. He was an accountant. And my mother brought up myself and my brother, single-handed, as they say. And I shouldn't say made a very good job of it, because that sounds like self-praise. I mean, she was marvellous, but she had to cope. My brother went away, joined the Merchant Navy, came back to Leeds, immediate post-war years, immediately took off for London again to be a civil servant. So I was brought up virtually as an only child. No remote show business background.
What about school? I mean, what were you like at school? Were you a funny boy in the playground?
I was Bilko at school. I think that's the nearest comparison. There's a lot of shame attached to it. I literally ran rackets at school, anything to avoid work. I remember selling the shortcut for the cross-country run in a sealed envelope. I think it was for tuppence. And, of course, I got taken by one of my peers who bought one, copied it, and sold it for a penny, so I was out of business. So I was really ashamed looking back. I was always looking for a shortcut in every sense of the word, and an angle. My last school report, marvellous master called Pip Kelsey, who I revered, he wrote, "He must learn that glibness is no substitute for knowledge." I always remember that, and I think that's carved in my head somewhere. And I thought, I'll make a living out of glibness one day. I'll kill you.
So, I mean, in a sense, you are set upon a kind of entrepreneurial course, I suppose. Given that kind of background, you're going to end up with some businessman or something.
Well, had the dice fallen another way, I don't know. I was a hustler. I suppose I was a hustler. I've always regarded myself as very shy and self-effacing, which my wife will tell you is not so. I'm always looking for the angle, and I'm very good at delegating, and I think I'm good at rowing people in and getting a group together and that's very satisfying, getting the elements together.
But you must have been bright at school, I mean, for all the school reports.
Glib, Michael.
Well,
glib is
bright. Well, you got to university, didn't you?
Well, quick-witted as opposed to intelligent. Uh-huh. I think there's a difference. Yes, I was the Blue Eyes who went to Leeds Grammar School. Then got an exhibition, not a scholarship, but I got into Leeds University, and they found me out very quickly.
Did they?
Because I was using the Oxford Companion to English Literature and using the cross-references and assembling an essay, you know. I soon drifted into singing with the university jazz band and being in student shows. And Leeds University is separated by University Road, if you remember. It still is to this day, I think. Mainly the union activities are one side of the road and the academic activities the other, and I was known for rarely crossing the road. It was terribly irresponsible, and I don't know what my dear mother thought. She never, there were no recriminations or anything, but my first year results were absolutely disastrous. English literature course it was.
What about another choice of record?
Another choice of record. Well, I'd want to laugh on the desert island, and the choice is so rich. So many comedians, so many marvellous writers are on record, but I had to get down to basics and think what would make me laugh most and what has joyous laughter on it all the way through. And it's Gerard Hoffnung at the Oxford Union, the tale of the... Well, I won't say. Let's hear a bit of it.
And I had to give information to the tourists who found themselves in this country for the first time and tell them what to do. You know, you will oblige your chambermaid by hanging your mattress out of the window every morning. All London brothels display a blue lamp. Ignore all left and right signs. These are merely political slogans. Zebra parking places provided everywhere. Have you tried the famous echo in the reading room of the British Museum?
We've talked about in the introduction all the people that you've worked for. Impossible question to ask you, but I mean, who have been the funniest?
Tommy Cooper, obviously.
Why Cooper?
Because you can't define why he was funny. I mean, Tom looked marvellous. I always said he was like sort of Mount Rushmore on legs. You know that nobody looked like that. The great Priestley said once that they're like Martians comics. A lot of comics are. I mean, Doddy looks amazing, doesn't he? And Les Dawson, you know, didn't always look like this. I was hit by a lift, you know. They looked like visitors from outer space who descended amongst us and made us laugh, and then, sadly, in Tom's case, and they go away again. But they don't go away because people still talk about Tommy and he's there on tape and everything to be seen. You couldn't really analyse it. It was the innocent, wasn't it? Really sort of knowing innocent.
When you write for somebody like Cooper, I mean, how difficult is it?
Very.
Yeah, because he's certainly, it's an individual and eccentric person, wasn't
Yes, indeed, and God bless him. He wasn't the greatest reader of a script. He could get hold of the idea and the fun of it, but it wasn't his game actually reading. The first time I ever wrote for him, I wrote the opening of a show, and I'd always noticed he said things twice a lot, so I wrote good evening, comma, good evening, full stop. And we all sat around the table, and Tom picked this piece of paper up and started reading. He said, "Good evening, good evening. What's this?" And I said, well, you say everything twice. He said, you write it once, I'll say it twice. You get the best of the bargain. And we once had a sketch set in a tiger's cage. And he said, I can't say tiger. And he pursued this matter for about a quarter of an hour. I can't say tiger. It's the art, yeah. Tiger, I can't say it. And kept illustrating this by saying tiger, driving us all mad. So the producer finally said, enough is enough, it's a lion's cage. And he was happy then.
One thing we're sure about all of them, they're not like us, are they?
And not like us at all.
No choice of record.
The world of gospel singing I find so exhilarating. I can see myself hand clapping and floating a foot above the sand on the island. And it was very hard to pick one of these, but I picked the queen, the dowager of gospel, Mahalia Jackson, and Didn't It Rain.
Rain on my lawn, didn't it, oh, my Lord, didn't it rain? Oh, didn't it rain, children, talk about rain on my lawn, didn't it, oh, my Lord, didn't it rain? Knock at the window, knock at the door. Cry, brother, Nora, can't you take a more? Knock right, no, you're full of sin. God got the key and you can't get in. Listen, hot rain, will you listen? Hot rain, just listen, hot rain. All day, all night, all day. Just listen. Had rain, just listen, had rain, just listen, had rain. Some moaning, some groaning, some praying. Well, oh, didn't it rain to dust? Rain on my lawn,
Mahalia Jackson, Didn't It Rain? That was recorded at the 1958 Newport Jazz Festival. Mary Crowe, what about your own performing? I mean, we left you...
What about it?
Well, what about it? We left you there at university, and this failed intellectual. I mean, you started on stage, didn't you? You started performing before you actually started writing.
Yes, indeed.
So
yes.
How did that come about?
Well, that came about, kicked out of university. It's like a bad film script, because Stanley Joseph, who's a friend to this day, manager of the City Varieties Theatre in Leeds, where they used to do the good old days and so on, always used to come and see the student show at the old Empire Theatre, and if he liked an act in the student show, he'd offer you a week's work, and he offered me a week's work in the university vacation while I was going through this trauma of working out what I was going to do. And I did a week there as a professional, very different world from showing off to your family and friends for charity, and that was a real school all in 1 week. And there was an agent from London in this agent said, did I want to turn professional? And I had the classic weekend of agonising, and I thought, well, I'd been offered a couple of retakes. I could have crawled back in, maybe, the tail between my legs. But I went into the magic world of show business straight afterwards and had about 6 weeks' work on what we called the number threes in those days.
What was that?
Regent Rotherham, the Royal Bilston, Luton. Oh, wonderful experience. And then I was out of work again, so I went back to Leeds and finished up as a stagehand at the Empire where I'd done the student show. Then I met David Nixon, who was starring the pantomime then, and he advised me to cut loose completely and go to London. And I came to London with a 17-day rail return ticket. I don't know what I thought I was going to do in 17 days. And the day before it expired, I got an audition at the Windmill.
Oh, the famous Windmill.
Yes, which was 36 shows a week. And I auditioned at 10:30 in the morning, and the great Van Damme, who ran the theatre, said, would you like to work here? And I said, yes, not realising you meant that day. And I was on the stage at 12:15 in my own clothes and borrowed makeup doing this awful act I did for my audition.
What spot did you have on the bill?
Oh, I can't remember, Michael. I can't remember. Because they didn't come to see you. That was the great tradition.
No, indeed not.
But what a great school. They came to see the girls. So you learn to die gracefully 6 times a day. That was another great learning process. And I was there for about 7 months. I don't know how many hundred shows that is. And that was... That was an amazing experience, that. Because when you went outside, if you got lucky and played bigger theatres, you were quite thrown by the laughter. You didn't know what to do with it. You'd been used to this reverent silence, and punctuated by the odd faint chuckle from some eccentric.
Another choice of record.
Another choice of record. Now, this is where my family at home all boo and jeer and say, here's his token classic. But it is a cliché and a great one. It's Mars from Holst's Planet Street, because that was the signature tune of a version of War of the Worlds I remember hearing as a boy on the radio. The days when radio was absolute king. And it stuck with me ever since. And that will conjure up a whole era of growing up and the joy of radio. Taking this vast console organ of a radio set up to the bedroom, giving yourself a sort of juvenile hernia so you could listen in bed to things like War of the Worlds. And this Mars from the Planet Street conjures up everything of that era.
From the Planet Suite by Gustav Holst. Extraordinary, of course. I mean, like you, I mean, I was part of that radio generation. It's very, very impressive and formative, isn't it, in the days that we grew up.
Somebody once said that radio at its peak was bigger than television will ever be, which was food for thought. Mm. It's like when Tommy Hendley died during the war, people five deep on the pavement like a state funeral, because the radio figures were giants to people at home. And I always think radio sounds if it's talking to you, and television looks as if it's trying to please everybody. You know what I mean? And radio doesn't demand you look at it. You can carry it about, and it's a companion, and it's a great spawner of imagination. It's all up to you. Like we're saying about painting a mental picture with jokes and routines, radio is a wonderful medium. You do half the work. You paint the picture in your head, and I think it's wonderful.
Do you prefer writing for radio or for...
I very rarely write for radio. I would love to write more for radio. It's harder work because you can't cut to a piece of film. Or
what about appearing though? I mean, you do a lot of radio.
I like radio very much.
Better than television?
Yes, I think it's a very clean, straightforward idiom. Like we're sitting here today, and there's five of us doing this show. It's lovely. There's no cameras moving about. There's no makeup. There's no costumes. And we've got no script to worry about. We're just chatting. It's a very intimate, straightforward medium, which has been mastered over so many years by the people here that you know you're in good hands and you can get on with it. There's very little extraneous stuff to get in the way.
Another choice of record, please, Mary.
Another choice of record. We're back to rhythm again, very much indeed. Marvellous man, country and western singer, also a very good actor. Been in Burt Reynolds films and things. Very funny man, good villainous actor. He's everything. And this, to me, his name is Jerry Reed, and this, to me, is the definitive version of Guitar Man.
Well, I quit my job down at the car wash, left my mama a goodbye note. By sundown, I left Kingston with my guitar up under my coat. I hitchhiked all the way down to Memphis, got a room at the YMCA. For the next 3 weeks, I went a-haunting them nightclubs looking for a place to play. Well, I thought my picking would set them on fire, but nobody wanted to hire a guitar man. Well, I nearly about starved to death down in Memphis. I run out of money and luck, so I bummed me a ride down to Macon, Georgia, on an overloaded poacher truck. I thumbed on down to Panama City, started checking out some of them all-night bars, hoping I could make myself a dollar making music on my guitar. Got the same old story, them all-night peers. There ain't no room around here for a guitar man, but don't need a guitar man, son. So I slept in hobo jungle, bombed 1,000 miles of track, till I found myself in Mobile, Alabama, at a club they called Big Jack's. A little four-piece band was jamming, so I took my guitar and I set in. I showed them what a band would sound like with a swinging little guitar man. Show 'em, son.
That was Guitar Man. You can't say Guitar Man, it's Guitar.
Guitar Man, yeah.
Jerry Reed. Barry Cryer, let's go back to that those windmill days. You left the windmill, and in fact you went on the West End stage, didn't you?
Yes, a musical called Espresso Bongo, named after Espresso Coffee, but nobody could pronounce that name. Written by Wolf Mankiewicz and Monty Norman and David Hennecke. It was a savaging the pop world of its day, and it was a marvellous piece of work. But if it was revived, it would have to be done as a period piece, because it was very much of the late 50s. And Paul Scofield, who'd never been in a musical, was the lead. We were all in awe of him. And he was marvellous. His singing was something to marvel at, because he had very good pitch and no sense of timing. He could get 1.5 bars ahead of the band. And Burt Rhodes, musical director, used to cut the band and keep the piano going until they found Paul again. So, marvellous singing voice. He didn't know he had, I don't think. But that was good training, too, because you were in a West End musical. Millie Martin was in that. And a girl who had 12 lines, I think, in 12 hours, called Susan Hampshire, who'd never appeared in the West End before.
Quite a cast, yes.
Very good cast. Charles Gray.
What about your own singing, actually? Because you had a recording career this time, didn't you?
Brief, yes. Three records with an option, which was dropped with a dull thud. But the historic occasion was, I think it was due to some contractual position. A man called Sheb Woolley, who was one of the baddies in High Noon, one of the guys who was waiting to kill Gary Cooper, waiting for Frank Miller at the station, wrote a song with a deathless title, Purple People Eater, which is a mammoth seller in America. So I did a modest cover version of it, but mine was issued in Scandinavia. This is, as I remember the details, and it was number one in Finland for about 3 weeks. Number one in Finland. And I will not take it to a desert island. Wild horses would not take it.
Do you know, it's the first this. You're the first man I've ever interviewed who had a number one in Finland.
There aren't many of us about.
This is true.
There aren't many of us about. Fridtjof Flugerson is the only other one, and I don't think you've had him on.
No, not lately. Anyway.
Not lately, no.
Would you like to choose another record, please?
I'd like to choose another record. Let's hear somebody who can really rock and roll. To me, I'm sorry if this is sacrilege to any listeners. To me, this is the King. This is Little Richard singing The Girl Can't Help It, the title song of the film of the same name. And rock and roll was the university era and coming into the business I'm in now. Marvellous period of my life. And if I was asked to sum it up, I would say Girl Can't Help It by Little Richard.
Can't help it, girl, can't help it. Can't help it, girl, can't help it. Thank you.
Richard and The Girl Can't Help It. Barakara, I suppose if I, looking back on your career, as I've done, the two names stand out as being significant in your life, Danny LaRue and David Frost. Could you explain the sort of significance? Danny, first of all.
Yes, I'd written one or two things for a review at the Fortune Theatre. Danny came in to see the show and asked who'd written them, and an old friend of mine, Ted Dix, composer, and myself were asked to write a show for his nightclub. He was at a nightclub called Winston's then, before he had his own, and that led to an association of 13 years. He's a friend to this day, but I actually worked with him writing the shows and being in them and his televisions and things for about 13 years. And it all links up, because when Danny got his own club in the 60s, David Frost came in and asked who'd written it, and I then started working with David, and that was a great cachet, because if you were a Frost writer then, a lot of doors opened. I was very lucky. So there was a direct link. Those two men, that's where I met Ronnie Corbett in the nightclub shows with Danny. He was a marvellous partner for Danny. And then, of course, the association continued with David, with Ronnie Corbett, who was joined by Ronnie Barker. John Cleese was in the show, The Frost Report, and that was, of course, was the birth of the two Ronnies.
It was an extraordinary period, wasn't it? With, I mean, those two shows that David did. I mean, for instance, I mean, who were the writers with you?
The writers with me, it sounds very grand. I mean, I was one of this amazing stable. David Nobbs, now a famous novelist, who I'm writing with again soon and very happy about it. David Nobbs was a writer, Dick Bosborough, Marty Feldman, John Cleese, Graham Chapman from Python, Terry Jones, Michael Palin. I mean, the lineup went on and on. And Tony Jay was involved in the shows. And
it's marvellous, isn't it, when those happy accidents, and they are accidents, occur where a group of people come together.
Yeah.
Somebody has to form the focal point, and it was David. Quite
I think David's always been a great entrepreneur, a gatherer together of people. For instance, Graham Chapman, whose background was Cambridge Footlights and everything, David put he and I and Eric Idle, who was I omitted from the list. He put us together to write a situation comedy for Ronnie Corbett with Rosemary Leach as his wife, which we did for quite a while. Eric went off to do a thing called Please Do Not Adjust Your Set. And Graham and I subsequently wrote a lot of situation comedies. Now, we were disparate backgrounds, but David could see, I don't know what he could see, some common sense of humour or something. And that was a very happy era working with...
How do you work with a collaborator? I mean, I would find it very difficult to write with somebody. I think writing is specifically about sitting down by yourself with a typewriter and putting your own thoughts on paper. I mean,
that chills me now, Michael. I hate writing on my own because I've had too much happy partnership. I think Frank Muir said it was like a marriage with none of the advantages. I mean, it's just you can try and write with somebody you admire a lot and it doesn't work at all because they have a different modus operandi or whatever. There's usually a walker. There's somebody who walks around the room. Graham Chapman used to walk around the room playing with his sideburns and smoking his pipe. And, Neil Shand and I have worked together a lot. I think we're both sitters. This is a first. David Nobbs used to prowl about a lot, and I used to sit there. I was sort of glorified temp, really, you know, right? Taking dictation.
So there'd be one still centre and the other one...
Yes, that's right. If two of you are walking about, I mean, it would all get out of hand. You wouldn't get a traffic pattern. You'd be crashing into each other.
Let's have no choice of record.
Now, as you can see, I'm going to be hopping about and halfway up the palm tree most of the time. There's only one really restful record in my selection. This isn't it. This is a record that gives me a freestyle every time I hear it start. It also exemplifies an era in my life. I subsequently met Alan Price and Chas Chandler, but this is The Animals and House of the Rising Sun.
That was House of the Rising Sun and the Animals. Marie-Claire, what about the career now? I mean, you split between... you're predominantly a writer, but I mean, you perform an awful lot as well. But how do you see it? I mean, would you prefer to perform more than write, or vice versa?
I've got no career sense. I'm just being very lucky with what happens. If you press me to an answer, yes, I would rather perform. I'm a ham. I don't think there's anything like... Particularly live, being disloyal to radio and television and everything, there's nothing like standing on wood with a real audience in front of you, which I still do. Mm. I do good old days without cameras now at the City Varieties in Leeds, where I started, and that, to a packed house, is such a joy. So, yes, basically a performer. It helps with the writing, too, if you've done a bit of performing, because maybe you've got a bit of an insight into how performers' minds work and what they might not like to do and what they'd like to do.
Looking back over this long career of 30 years, I mean, being involved in...
It's certainly true.
I mean, being involved in making people laugh or assisting other people to make people laugh. How has it changed the job? Has it become more complicated, more difficult? Or is it true that the jokes remain the same?
The jokes and the form... That old thing about there are only five or six jokes in the world, completely untrue, but there are probably only five or six formulae, all good stories and jokes and routines answer to a particular formulae. What's changed, I think, is the subject matter. There aren't the taboos there were in the old days. You're much more restricted. And now I think people will view what you do objectively in the treatment of it and how you've done it. The taboo subjects are very few now. So it's actually widened in that sense.
Mm. What about the people coming through? I mean, you've, again, as I said, worked with all the great established names in comedy over the past 30 years. There's a kind of a new move now, defined as being alternative comedians. I'm not quite sure.
Doesn't mean anything. I hate that. And they hate it too, quite rightly.
But all right, let's say the younger group coming through. I mean, do you see any hope for the future in there?
Oh, very much so, yeah. They act more. Victoria Wood, for instance, with the great Julie Walters, is a typical example, writer-performer. It's very acting comedy now. That Rick Mayles and Aid Edmondson's and Alexis Sales. Ben Elton, to me, is a throwback. I mean, that's a compliment. I told him. He reminds me of comics of the past like Arthur English and Max Miller. This ability to dominate an audience with the sheer power of the presence. Oh, there's a lot of talent about it. Some marvellous people. A man called Norman Lovett. I think he's great. I mean, he talks about having conversations with cockroaches and living alone in a bed sitter and coming home late just to annoy himself, cooking the dinner and then throwing it against the wall and having a row with himself. I mean, it's great stuff. Oh, no, there's no shortage of talent about.
And what about, again, an impossible question, but you look back all this sort of 30 years, what's the line? Is there one line or one joke that you wish you'd written or indeed you did? I mean, is there one thing that kind of sums up being funny, the business of being funny to you?
Well, there's a man being more current again because my memory's going these days. Who are you again? Oh, Michael, that's it. there's a man around at the moment who we've seen and heard quite a bit of in England this year called Stephen Wright, an American, who works in a very deadpan, monotone sort of way. And every line he says is a gem, I think. He says things like, you can have everything. I mean, where would you put it? And I mean that, the economy of that. And this guy had false teeth with braces. I've got a map of America at home. At actual size, it says 1 mile equals 1 mile. I spent last summer folding it. And that, to me, is that he's given me a lot of pleasure recently.
Final choice of record.
Final choice of record. We're going to relax finally, Michael. This is when the sun's going down and I'm having a drink out of half a coconut, whatever I've managed to find. I think this is the most beautiful arrangement. I don't know who did this arrangement. You might be able to tell me. It is wonderful, of an old standard. The song is I Get Along Without You Very Well, and the singer is Carly Simon.
I get along without you very well. Of course I do. Except when soft rains fall and drip from leaves, then I recall the thrill of being sheltered in your arms. Of course I do. But I get along without you very well. I've forgotten you just like I should. Of course I have. to hear your name. Or someone's laugh that is the same. But I've forgotten you just like I should. What a guy. What a fool am I to think my breaking heart could give a move. What's in store? Should I fall once more? No, it's best that I stick to my tune.
I get along without you very well, Carly Simon. Barry, you're now on your desert island with your records. You have to imagine that a tidal wave comes along, seven are swept away, you're left with one. Which one would you care to preserve?
I think the Hoffnung, in spite of all that exciting music and atmospheric music, I think I'd want to laugh. I think the madness might be ever-present. I think I'd like Dear Gerard Hoffnung on the desert island.
And what about the book? Assume you've got the Bible, the complete works of Shakespeare.
And Where to Eat in Deal. can I have a complete J.B. Priestley in a crate? I mean, I'd like everything. I think I've got nearly everything at home, if I can have that.
Was he a hero?
Oh, yes, very much. And I did meet him. I was goaded by Graham Chapman one day. He said, I'm sick of you talking about Priestley. Why don't you ring him up? And I said, you don't ring a man like that up. But we did. And he invited us down for tea. We did get to know him. And my wife and I still see Jaquetta, his wife. And his books are like a great big armchair you get into rather than reading a book, and I think that would be the greatest desert island reading.
What about the luxury object inanimate?
The luxury object inanimate would be, is this object plural? It would be a tape recorder with a cassette in it. And the cassette would be of my home with our four children, four cats, four dogs. The terrapins have gone, sadly. You probably heard about that. Bugsy the rabbit, who doesn't make much noise, the phone ringing and my wife shouting dinner's ready with various adjectives littered in, because that's what I've missed most. It might be too poignant, but I think I would like a tape of this Charing Cross station that I call home.
Barry Cryer, thank you very much indeed.
Thank you, Michael.